Cantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Never Better, Two Kids, Their Dad, and His Wife's Ghost, by Gonzalo Riddell, narrated by Kyle Snyder. My wife, Erica, could be fond of a sappy story, a tearjerker. I might have found this one a little cliched, but she would have appreciated it. High school sweethearts. Boyfriend and girlfriend from down the way. From the same neighborhood, actually. Knew her back in kindergarten. Would you believe I actually had a crush on her in kindergarten? The feeling wasn't reciprocated. That much I know. I'm not sure she would have even remembered me, had she not looked back through old school photos and seen me as a child. She couldn't deny I was in her class, because there I was in her classroom photo. But what did she remember about me? I don't know. You'd have to ask her. That is, if you could. If she was around. We met up again in high school. That old crush came back, but with hormonal high school intensity. I was smitten with her again in a whole new way. Again, I don't think she was particularly impressed. I was a pretty obnoxious kid. But I played the long game. I got in good with her circle of friends. It was a good circle, honestly. We're all still friends. So it wasn't just some ruse. But, my feelings got out. I blurted out something to one of my friends, and that friend blabbed, and it got around to Erica, which was embarrassing at the time. But hey, it all worked out. We got married, had kids. Then, she gets sick. Really sick. That's a story Erica would have eaten up. I'd have busted her chops about it. You gonna watch your sad terminal illness movie? I might have said offhandedly. She'd be on the couch, blanket over her lap, the pink blanket that only felt nice on one side, the side that didn't pick up all the lint. Maybe she'd have a bowl of popcorn or crackers at the ready. You don't have to watch if you don't want to. That's what I imagine her saying. Sometimes it just feels good to feel sad. That is something she almost certainly would have said. I'd have scoffed. Maybe I'd have watched. But I probably wouldn't. Cancer stories have never been my thing. I find them depressing. We had two boys together. Elliot and then Charlie, 3 years later. Not even Charles, just Charlie. They're 10 and 7 now. Sometimes I tell them stories about their mom. They used to come up a lot because it was important that we remember. Stories still come up, but the sadness around the stories is mostly gone. There's a lightness to these stories now, a lack of urgency. When I do tell them things about their mom, I need them to understand a few caveats. One, she isn't here to defend herself. Not that she's the type of person who needed defending. She rarely made herself a fool or came away from a scenario looking like the bad guy. But these are the stories we like best about people. Ones that humanize us. Or that create a sense of drama. I could tell them that she and I like driving around and going thrift store shopping and watching movies and being in each other's presence. But those sorts of stories rarely make for engaging narratives. Two, not only is she not here to defend herself, she also isn't here to correct me on the details. I tend to forget timelines, to conflate incidences. When she and I would relay stories to friends, she was always correcting me on the things I'd gotten wrong. She'd remind me, "No, that didn't happen on that day," or, "We were living at whatever apartment when that occurred," forcing me to acknowledge that my memory is a sham and that every true story I tell is made into fiction by accident. Three, this is probably the most important thing I tell them. As much as I want to tell stories about her and the things she did, the way she was, it's all filtered through my memories. It all exists in the way I see things, the effect it had on me, and the ways in which those memories have stayed with me. Any story I tell about Erica is really a story about me. It's about the way she responded to my jokes, or the things she said that left an impression on me, my feelings about her. I have to remind the kids that every story I tell about her is really about my relationship with her, and that getting to know her through my stories is to get to know me better. They say that people are never really gone as long as they're remembered, and that by talking about the person, you keep them alive through memory. But maybe it's more about keeping ourselves alive. When a person dies, those memories you share together, they're half gone. It's up to you to remember them. It's up to other people to remember them when you are gone. When you die, and your memories have vanished into the ether, you have to ask, did the things that happened in your life actually happen? When you try to remember your past, and it's fuzzy, and you're unsure of the timeline or the order of events, how can you be sure what you experienced is real? Of course, I don't say all this to my children. I still have the decency to rein it in a bit. I don't want them to develop a complex or anything. At a certain point, you learn to guide a person's response when you tell them that your wife is dead. That, even at your relatively young age, you're a widower. It comes up in conversation more than you'd think. Even when you don't want to talk about it, it's there. It's the foundation by which you live. Let's say you're on a date. You've lived long enough in solitude and you're ready to go out and re-experience life. She asks you about your kids, because you've mentioned them in conversation. She says, "Do you and their mom share custody?" It's implied that you two have separated. And that's true, in a manner of speaking. You say, "No, their mom is deceased." You've chosen those words carefully. It isn't your wife, but their mom. Even though you still see her as your wife, because you've never broken up, but you want to suggest distance, personal growth. You aren't hung up on her anymore. You aren't married to a ghost. Deceased is also a good word. It's clinical, but not entirely informal. She's dead comes across as blunt. Passed on is vague, and it requires the listener just a moment to work through the euphemism. But deceased is emphatic. "Oh," they say when you've told them. Usually a person will screw up their face for a moment. Sometimes it's genuine, and sometimes it isn't. There is always something performative about these moments, both for me and for the person receiving this information. "That's awful," they say. "I'm so sorry to hear that." You put your hands out so that you're showing your palms, as if to say, "I know, I know." What you actually say is, "Thank you." You say, "It was a long time ago." Your timing is precise. You've said this before, dozens of times. You've conveyed this information to others in different ways. This way is always the smoothest, the least difficult for you, the easiest for the person to process. There is a negotiation at play. The person you're speaking to will try to convey that they are willing to hear your story, as much as you want to tell. But they do not want to overburden you. They know that this may not be the time or place to discuss matters of grief and mortality. And you? You just don't want to kill the vibe. So you allow a moment to pass, to let the somberness run its course. You don't want to crack a joke too soon. But you do want to crack a joke eventually. "I guess this way I can have hot widower vibes," you say, "like in an old gothic romance novel." Your date smiles at this. You say, All I need now is a dusty old manor on the moors, with a double-wide staircase, and portraits of my ancestors painted onto velvet canvases, where the eyes move when you walk across the room. Or something. You've addressed it, and now you're free to move on. At least for right now. Free to move on. At some point during our high school friendship, as I said, it became known that I had a crush on Erica. I told a friend who told a friend who told her. It certainly wouldn't have been me who told her this. I was too chicken shit at the time to make something like that clear. She didn't see me in that romantic way. We were both young, and I don't think dating was much of a priority to her then. But, as it happens sometimes when you find out someone has a crush on you, you begin to see them in a new way. I was unaware this was happening to her. While I was trying to expand my social circle and date outside my friend group, Erica was quietly developing a crush on me. Somehow it came to a head one weekday evening, like a Tuesday or a Wednesday, when I was hanging out with a friend at my house and Erica was hanging out at another friend's house. It was like one of those Technicolor musicals where the screen gets split in two. On one side, there's me being coerced into asking her out, and on the other side, there's Erica being coerced into asking me out. It was all terribly juvenile, I'm sure. But that didn't make the emotions any less real. I was terrified of making myself vulnerable, but was just as terrified of disrupting our friend circle at school. I'd have to spend a significant amount of time with her in class for the remainder of that year and probably through high school. The last thing I needed was to feel embarrassed that whole time. But there I was, gathering up the courage to call her. "Do it," my friend said. "I hear she'll say yes." "I don't know," I said. This all seemed like a big put-on, like I was being set up for failure and mockery.
"Don't be a coward."
"Fine," I said. Next thing I knew, my friend had dialed the number and handed me the receiver. "Hello," I said, gritting my teeth, pretending I was too cool to be scared. "Is Erica there?" I could hear her friend stifle a giggle.
"She sure is," she said, passing the phone. "Hello?" Erica said.
I skipped the general pleasantries and all that. There was a task at hand, and I needed to get to it before the fear could catch up to me. "Hi, Erica," I said.
Hey, do you want to go out sometime?"
Okay, she said. "Yes?"
"Huh?"
A huge wave of relief came over me. She said yes?
Holy smokes, she said yes! "Okay, awesome."
In the background, I could hear her friends quietly cheering her on. Erica and I both laughed.
"Well," I said, "I'll see you at school tomorrow."
Having got what I wanted, I hung up before having the chance to make a fool of myself. "There," I said to my friend. "That wasn't so hard." I can understand how it might seem like I'm taking apart my wife, who was once flesh and blood and very much alive. Breaking her down into pieces and then reassembling her like stripped car parts into little more than anecdotes and plot devices. It might seem exploitative or ghoulish. Imagine how I feel about it. Our early dates were so naive. We took walks around the neighborhood, went to movies, went thrift store shopping. Actually, those all sound pretty fun, even now. I was always trying to move a little too fast for her. I wanted to hold hands and make out well before she was ready. She was a shy kisser, and we went out for months before even trying that. It's understandable. We were new to this. Being the last parent alive puts a certain pressure on a person. I used to be a risk taker,
When I was 18, I hitchhiked halfway across Canada, from Winnipeg to Vancouver, for the fun of it. The next year, I went out east, from Winnipeg to Montreal. My mom was worried about me for obvious reasons, scared I'd be murdered and mutilated, left on the side of the road. She made me promise to stick to the Trans-Canada Highway, which spans the country end to end, so that I might leave a traceable path. I can't imagine doing a thing like that now. Hitching rides with strangers. Just like I can't imagine skydiving, bungee jumping, or any other sport with a high risk of orphaning my children. A few months ago, I slipped on some stairs and suffered a nasty landing. Not many stairs, just a few. The kids were playing at a neighbor's house across the street, and I had just baked an apricot crumble. It was a rainy afternoon, and something warm and sugary felt like an appropriate way of thanking my neighbors for watching the kids and giving me a few free hours. I stepped out onto the stairs descending from my front door, and my foot slipped on the wet wood. It felt exaggerated and cartoonish, like something out of Bugs Bunny. I protected the ceramic dish and not my body. My upper spine took the brunt of the fall. We've all fallen before, but this was different. The sensation was something new. I panicked, convinced that I'd done forever-type damage to myself. Immediately, I imagined my kids adjusting to a life where their father could no longer walk. I looked across to the neighbor's house, hoping someone had caught sight of this brutal fall, that someone would come to my rescue. I called for help, but the impact had winded me so badly that my words came out in ugly grunts, like the bark of an injured seal. The apricot crumble looked unharmed, but it was getting drizzled on. Luckily, someone did spot the fall, and he and his son rushed over to help. The man asked if I'd hit my head. No, thank God. This was a new thought to panic over. He wanted to know if I could move my toes. I was pretty sure I felt them move inside my shoes. He tried to raise me to my feet, but I waved him away for the time being so I could move on my own time. I pointed to the dessert dish. Can you bring that inside out of the rain? It came out a wheeze. The teenager put two optimistic thumbs up. Hopefully you don't have to go to the hospital, he chimed. His father glared at him. What? The boy asked. Seemed a little insensitive, his dad said. I groaned and coughed. I have to say, it was a labor to get anything out. I have to say I agree with your father. The rest of the day I was something of an emotional wreck, often bursting into tears in front of the kids. I tried to organize a comfortable position on the floor, a yoga mat offering the barest of support. But any slight shift in my upper back or movement in my shoulders would make my body scream at me for having dared to move. I replayed the fall in my mind, and each time I came closer and closer to hitting my head. I was this close to dying on those stairs. Or maybe I wasn't. Please take it easy on me, I told the kids, my eyes dampening. Daddy's in a lot of pain. There's a scar between my eyes from a cereal bowl. I was unloading the clean dishes from the dishwasher in our old apartment, and I noticed some hardened oatmeal stuck to the bowl. Having gone through the hot wash and then the drying cycle, it was more like concrete. I chipped away at the formation with my thumbnail, grinding it down as best I could. My thumb slipped off the bowl, and the bowl snapped back like an elastic, into my face. The dull rim of a ceramic IKEA bowl hit me between the eyes, and I bled like an old-time wrestler. You can still see the mark. This is all to say, I don't rely on my wits alone to keep me alive. Erica and I dated steadily into our 20s before we moved in together. But until then, we each lived with our parents. We would drive around, looking for quiet places to fool around. We may not have had a lover's lane, but we did have industrial parks and hidden parking lots. I have no idea what went on inside the buildings, but I have first-hand knowledge of what happened outside them. We would fool around in the back seat, fogging up the windows, and when another car would drive by, we'd stop moving and slump down low, pretending like nothing was going on. Like this was some normal, erratically parked car behind some building, next to the garbage bins. One time, a car pulled up outside our parked car, and some angry, burly dude got out and banged on my window. "What are you doing to my sister?" he shouted at me, as if he didn't know. Erica had shielded her face from him up to that point. Then she looked right at him. Erica didn't have any brothers. The man recognized his error and threw his hands up in the universal sign of apology. I have no idea where his actual sister was. Neither did he, clearly. Probably in another parking lot somewhere. He backed away to his car. "My mistake," he said. I thought this was the funniest thing to happen all week. But Erica was horrified, so we didn't get to finish up. Ever since the kids were babies, I dreamed of the day they'd be adults. They'd have their own friends, their own hustles. Maybe they'd have girlfriends or boyfriends of their own, backaches, student loans. I imagined myself turning to them with so much sober gravitas and saying, "Hey, guess what? I totally had sex with your mom." It just wouldn't be funny now. I think about what it'd be like for her if I had died instead. Would she find herself on a dating site? With the horror stories I've heard from women, I can only wonder at the caliber of creep who would talk to her. I picture her on dates, having flings, feeling heartbreak. I get jealous at these thoughts, but not in the way I would be if we separated. I'm not jealous of the men in these scenarios, the ones in her life instead of me. I'm jealous of her, because she gets to stay behind and live, and I don't, because I'm dead. Elliot and Charlie come from a line of single parents. My father left us when I was 7, and my mom raised me and my brothers, Pablo and Rodrigo. They were 12 and 17 when he left. My parents maneuvered things behind my back. I don't blame them, on account of my being 7. I don't know exactly what my brothers knew while it was happening, or if they only understood the details years later. We went to Chile over Christmas and New Year's at the end of the 1980s. My parents grew up in Chile. They escaped a hairy political climate in the 1970s and moved to Canada with Rodrigo, who was the only one born at the time. When I say we went to Chile, I don't mean to say we went together. We traveled in two separate groups, for reasons that were not clearly explained to me then. Pablo and I went with our mom, and Rodrigo and my dad traveled together on a separate itinerary. They'd be a week behind us, was what I was told. So we returned to Winnipeg sometime in January, Pablo and my mom and me. My dad and Rodrigo were due to follow us there a week later, but Rodrigo flew back alone. My dad stayed behind. He'd be back soon, I was told. Within a few days, my mom broke the news to me. I had been playing by myself in the backyard, building paths and structures in the snow. When I came inside, my mom was sitting on a chair in the middle of the kitchen. I supposed she hadn't wanted to sit under the bright kitchen light, so she'd turned on the hallway light instead, and it cast a discomforting, eerie glow in the room, full of long shadows. She had been bracing herself to have this conversation. I remember she sat rigid and tense.
"I have to talk to you about something," she said.
I removed my snow-covered boots and went to her. She took a deep breath and laid it out as clearly as she could.
"It's about your father," she said. "He isn't coming home."
"What?" I could feel my stomach dropping through the floor.
He has decided to stay in Chile to live there.
That was all it took for everything to change. A couple of sentences. Then the world was different. That would happen to me a few more times in life. It happens to all of us. I can only imagine how my mom was feeling when she told me. How she must have rehearsed the words in her head before I came inside. I had to do the same thing once as an adult. Tell Elliot that his mom wasn't coming home. Erica and I didn't move in together until our early 20s. She was ready to make the jump from her parents' place before I was, and it wasn't until she began looking for apartments in earnest that I decided to make the jump too. She had planned on rooming with a friend, and when that fell through, I took it as a sign to grow up and move out with her. Our first apartment was roughly the size of a utility closet. The building was about 100 years old, and it was run by a caretaker named Edith, who was born around the time they laid the foundations. She was 93, and she was insistent on still doing her job in her golden years. I hope it was for a sense of purpose and not financial necessity. She had an English accent, like the teapot in Beauty and the Beast. After living there for a time, I noticed that deep below our kitchen sink, the pipes were emitting an ominous bubbling that suggested something might explode and erupt. I reported the problem to Edith. "The building just does that," she said, shooing the problem away with a dismissive wave. "I just say the building gets the gurgledy-burgledies." The day we moved in, Erica had to work through the afternoon while I loaded boxes into the apartment, and I had to be at work in the evening when she came home. When we weren't going to school, she worked at a shoe store in the mall and I was at a pizza place, the same one I'd worked at since I was 16. She'd expected me to unpack at least some of the boxes, but I wasn't a particularly motivated person. I'd only opened one box, the one with the cutlery, so I could dig out a large spoon and then use that spoon to scoop a heroic dollop of ice cream into my mouth. Then I'd run a bath for myself and smoked a joint, leaving the unsmoked half on the rim of the tub. Erica didn't need to be a forensic investigator to trace the events that took place before her arrival. When I came home from my own shift, she'd only just finished unpacking the boxes, and she was pretty annoyed at having done all of it on her own. She'd been expecting to come home to a fair amount of work, but not like this. It was our first apartment in what was to be a partnership, and I had set the bar super low. She was a great audience for my jokes. I missed that as much as anything, hearing her laugh. I chased that sound, the timbre of a good giggle. It was meditative, like wind chimes. But when a joke horrified her, her mouth made the most perfectly shocked O. I was young and insensitive and willing to cross any line to get that reaction. Sometimes when I imagine the alternate universe scenario, where I died and she lived, I become fiercely jealous of some guy coming along and getting those laughs. Sorry, fictional dating app guy. You can't have those laughs. They're mine. Those first few years living together were pretty fun, once we'd established our space. Not only was the apartment absurdly small, but the window separating the den from the bedroom had been knocked out sometime before we'd moved in. I would stay up late after my work shift watching movies after she went to bed, and the sound and lights often kept her awake. I often left dirty socks and dishes scattered about the floor. I guess I should say living there was fun for me, and probably a pain in the ass for her. It must not have been too bad for her, though, because when our lease expired, we moved into a bigger apartment, in the basement just beneath us. We toted our junk and our cat down the stairs, and suddenly we had room to maneuver. We cooked dinners, watched TV, cracked jokes, had sex, enjoyed each other's company whenever our schedules aligned. We didn't have to live for anyone else. It was okay to be selfish when we wanted to be. We were only responsible to ourselves. Erica wanted her great-grandmother's engagement ring as her own. She clued me into how much new engagement rings were meant to cost, and I blessed that woman for her thriftiness and sentimentality.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?